You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, Episode 87, Exorcism of Demons as part of the Messianic Profile. I'm your layman, Trey Strickland. And he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hi, Mike. How you doing?
Very good. How are you, Trey?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm excited about this Valentine's special.
Oh, boy, the Valentine's special. You know, I didn't even think about it in those terms.
Yeah.
Well, today we do want to talk about exorcism as part of the Messianic profile. If this brings, you know, if this sets your heart to fluttering, I guess, you know, then we did our job. But this is a topic that has come up a couple of times. You're just sort of really blowing by it, just mentioning it. I couldn't even really tell you specifically where I've mentioned it in past episodes, but thought this would be good, a good landing place for an episode of its own. And it's, you know, sort of the content that, you know, our listeners like. It's not in the unseen realm, so this would be an example of something I'd get into in a subsequent book, but you're going to get it here first. So we ought to, you know, just jump in here and say something about it. Now, for those of you who are familiar with Unseen Realm, the book, or have heard me, you know, talk about Unseen Realm, you'll know that typically I say something about what I refer to as the Messianic profile. And that is the reality that what is given to us in the Old Testament in terms of who the Messiah would be, what he'd be like, what he'd do, what he'd say, all that sort of thing, none of that is really spelled out in very specific verses. I mean, it's hard to find more than one line saying something about the Messiah. And in the Unseen Realm, I talk about how this is important because it factors into what Paul said in 1 Corinthians 2, that had the rulers of this world, the powers of darkness, known what the plan was, they never would have crucified the Lord of glory. And the idea is that the profile, and specifically the plan, was deliberately obscured. You had to sort of, you could only really tell what the plan was and the fullness of the picture in hindsight, because then you would be able to go back and pick up, you know, the parts of the profile scattered in 100 places in the Old Testament, put them all together, and you get this complete picture of, you know, who the Messiah would be, what he was supposed to do, what he was about, what the plan was, what the end game was, all these sorts of things. And you only get part of that that's really obvious. There are a lot of things that Jesus does and says that aren't easy to sort of process. Why? How does that relate to who he is and what he's doing? And I want to read a little excerpt from Unseen Realm to sort of, again, set up the problem here. Because in short terms, when Jesus shows up and starts exorcising demons in the Gospels, everyone sort of, you get the feel that, oh, well, this is what the Messiah is supposed to do. But there is no verse in the Old Testament. There's no passage. There's no prophecy about the Son of David, the Messiah, casting out demons. You don't get it. In fact, demons are only referred to twice, and they're not really the demons of the New Testament, the Shadim of the Old Testament. Again, the term refers to a territorial entity, a territorial guardian, and I talk about that in Unseen Realm a good bit. That's not what a demon is according to the Gospels. Those are two different critters, so to speak, so you don't even really get that hardly at all, and you don't get it clearly at all. You get a few little obscure kind of side references to ideas that would be associated with the demons as we think of them in the Gospels. You get a little of that in the Old Testament, but it's really hard to even detect that that's what you're reading when you go through certain passages. But readers of the Unseen Realm are sort of familiar with that, but I want to read this one section about the Messianic profile again to help further set up the topic. So I wrote, "By God's design, the Scripture presents the Messiah in terms of a Messianic profile that can only be discerned after the pieces are assembled. Paul tells us why in 1 Corinthians 2:6-8. If the plan of God for the Messiah's mission had been clear, the powers of darkness would never have killed Jesus. They would have known that his death and resurrection were the key to reclaiming the nations forever. Chances are good that you've heard the New Testament mistakenly read back into the Old hundreds of times. Therefore, you might be surprised to hear me say that the Old Testament profile of the Messiah was deliberately veiled." Then skipping ahead a little bit, this is pages 241, 242. I write this. Even after the resurrection, the disciples had to have their minds supernaturally open to see a suffering Messiah. The risen Jesus says that explicitly in Luke 24. This is verses 44 through 45. These are my words that I spoke to you while I was still with you, that everything that is written about me in the law of Moses and the prophets and the Psalms must be fulfilled. Then he opened their minds to understand the scriptures. So this is after the fact. I mean, the risen Christ is standing in front of them, and he still has to open their minds. And a big part of the reason is because the information is just scattered. It's blown up into 100, you know, or pieces or so, that only in hindsight can they be properly put back together and parsed. And my last statement here from the book, the point is straightforward. Only someone who knew the outcome of the puzzle, who knew how all the elements of the messianic mosaic would come together, could make sense of the pieces. Jesus had to enable the disciples to understand what the Old Testament was simultaneously hiding and revealing. It wasn't a matter of reading a verse here and there. So again, that's from pages 241 through 242 of Unseen Realm. Now, to sort of bullet point the topic for today, what we have here, you know, in the New Testament, specifically in the Gospels, is the title Son of David is found only in the Synoptic Gospels. So that's element number one. Element number two is that title is associated with a figure who heals and exorcises demons in the Gospels. Third point, while healing is a clear part of the messianic profile in the Old Testament, you know, remember Jesus quotes a passage from Isaiah to that effect that includes healing. So while that part's kind of clear, exorcising demons, casting demons out, is not clear at all. There is nothing in the Old Testament, at least to surface reading, that is about this. So where in the world would they get this idea? Why would people living, you know, during the experiences of you know, the incarnation, Jesus' first advent, when he's going around casting out demons, why would they just look at that and say, well, of course, you know, this is the Son of David. This is what the Son of David's supposed to do. Where would they get this idea? What preconditioned them to expecting that this was going to happen? What preconditioned them to the fact that once they saw somebody do this, they said, aha, you know, we have here the Son of David, the Messiah. What was it that led them to that point where they could process what was going on correctly? So that's what we want to talk about. And we really have to begin, surprisingly enough, in the Old Testament. And this is going to be some obscure stuff, but I'm going to quote one passage in the Old Testament. Then I'm going to quote it in the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, again, that a lot of people, a lot of Jews or Gentiles, would have been familiar with. I mean, mostly Jews before, you know, we have the first advent, because, you know, if you're a Gentile, you don't really have any interest in reading stuff that Jews wrote. I mean, if you're an intellectual, you might, but again, the masses don't. When Gentiles start becoming converted after, you know, the resurrection or the ministry of the apostles, well, then you get a lot of Gentiles reading the Septuagint because, hey, that's your Bible. You know, this is where the Messiah was presented. Well, prior to that, again, you do have something in the Septuagint that the Jewish community, because they're the ones who are going to be reading this, either in Hebrew or the Targums, Aramaic, or in this case, the Septuagint, they're going to be familiar with this idea. And so I'm going to start with a passage from 1 Kings 4. I'm going to read it, both versions, and then we're going to go into the Dead Sea Scrolls and talk about extra psalms that are in the Dead Sea Scrolls, at least one of which actually shows up in the Septuagint. So again, people would have been familiar with the material. So prepping it that way, here we go. In 1 Kings 4, 29 through 34, the Masoretic text, and again, the traditional Masoretic text reads as follows. And God gave Solomon wisdom and understanding beyond measure, and breadth of mind like the sand on the seashore, so that Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the people of the East and all the wisdom of Egypt. Skip into verse 32. He, Solomon, also spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. He spoke of trees, from the cedar that is in Lebanon to the hyssop that grows out of the wall. He spoke also of beasts and birds and reptiles, fish, so on and so forth. So that's 1 Kings 4, 29 through roughly, you know, 33, right around there. So we have the mention of Solomon. Solomon is obviously son of David, king. Okay, he's going to be a messianic figure in that sense. And we have here the information that he spoke 3,000 proverbs and his songs were 1,005. Big deal. You know, I mean, how do you get casting out demons from that? Well, you don't, but it begins sort of a journey that you know, is initiated in what's said here about Solomon that will get picked up in other material. In the Septuagint, it's slightly different. Okay, the difference here is in verse 32. And Solomon spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 5,000. So there's a lot more songs in the Septuagint version than there are in the Masoretic text version. And that's because, as we move to the Dead Sea Scroll material, that's because the Jewish community, and of course the community that's part of the community that would have produced the Septuagint, knew of lots of other psalms. And we're going to focus on one of those that shows up in the Dead Sea Scroll material that is actually not only interesting, but references, and here's the key thought, the scrolls material references what we just read in 1 Kings 4 about the songs and the, I'm going to use a very suggestive word here, the utterances of Solomon. Okay, so this is 11Q, okay, 11Q Psalm Scroll, and the abbreviation is AP superscript A. In Numbers, it's 11Q 5, column 27. For those of you who have Dead Sea Scroll stuff, you can go look this up, but I'm going to read you parts of it. So this is a psalm about David. So we read here at the beginning, this is line 2, David, son of Jesse, was wise, and a light like the light of the sun, and learned, and perfect in all his paths before God and men. And then we have a blank. And the Lord Yahweh gave him a discerning and enlightened spirit. And he wrote psalms, 3,600, and songs to be sung before the altar over the perpetual. And then there's a gap in the text. Line 9. And all the songs which he spoke were 446. And songs to perform over the possessed, 4 of them. So you actually have a reference in this extra psalm to David, okay, David composing songs to perform over the possessed. The total, again, of all of this was 4,050. Again, the total of his total output when you get down to that particular line, line 10 in that Dead Sea Scroll text. Now, the word translated possessed is more literally someone who has been assaulted, someone who has been, you know, accosted. Again, the implication is by, you know, some external force. But it's just an odd line. Songs to perform over the possessed or over the assaulted, 4 of them. And the last line here, and all these he spoke through the spirit of prophecy, which had been given to him from before the Most High. So God gave him these songs to sing, so on and so forth. Now, in the same Dead Sea Scroll, in a different column, column 19, line 15, we read this, where David says, let not Satan rule over me, nor an evil spirit. Let neither pain nor evil purpose, again, conquer me. Now, part of that line, part of, you know, these snippets that I've read, part of this material shows up in the Septuagint as what the Septuagint calls Psalm 151. Now, if you know your Bible, if you know the book of Psalms, there's only 100, I think there's 150 Psalms here. And, you know, you've got this extra Psalm, you know, the Masoretic text, you know, we've got this nice, you know, neat number here. Where in the world do we get this extra Psalm? Well, if you think about the Psalms, let's just do this a little bit. There are references in the Psalms to the Psalms of David and others, not just David, but we're going to zero in on David here. The Psalms of David being collected. And this was the process. They were collected and put into the book so that in the Masoretic text, we have 150 total. And there are even places in the Psalms where it says, and this is the end of the songs of David, son of Jesse. But then afterwards, you get more Psalms of David. And that's because the collecting kept going. So at one point, you know, they had a collection, Psalms of David, and then an editor, you know, who was putting all this stuff together into the book that we know as Psalms. An editor says, hey, these are the Psalms of David, the songs of David, and this is all that we have. But then they find more, and those get added subsequently to those editorial comments in the book of Psalms as we have it today. Now, I mention that because here we have a 151st Psalm that actually winds up in Dead Sea Scrolls and Dead Sea Scroll material, and it was added to the collection that becomes part of the Septuagint. So in the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, if you turn to the book of Psalms, you're going to have an extra one. You're going to have Psalm 151. And in that Psalm, you get, again, some of this material about don't let Satan rule over me or an evil spirit. Of course, the implications are because of what, you know, David had written, you know, songs to perform over the possessed, you know, that he has power to deliver people from being bound by demons. Now, let's go to another one, Psalm 91. This is Psalm 91, which, again, you have your traditional version, okay, that you would read in most translations, translating the Masoretic text. You have a version of this that comes from the Dead Sea Scrolls, Psalm 91 at Qumran. Again, and not coincidentally, it is part of this same scroll, the 11Q Psalm scroll that I've been quoting already. And then, of course, you also have a version of this in what becomes known as the Septuagint. Now, I'm going to read you this. There are four things in here that are very interesting that speak to this issue. And for those of you who remember the Fern and Audrey episode, Fern and Audrey and I have discussed some elements of this particular psalm because of the work they do. Again, they don't do renunciation prayers or anything like that. They're not deliverance ministry. What they do is different, but they have used the material in this psalm and some other things to help them do what they do. And I think you'll understand why that's relevant as we read through this. So I'm just going to go, you know, we'll pick, you know, one of the versions because I'm going to actually link out to a few things and then talk about where it might be different. But we read here Psalm 91, "He who dwells in the shelter of the Most High." Okay, now look at the reference. We already had Psalm 151. Again, don't let Satan rule over me. We already had a portion of an extra, you know, extra psalm material that had songs about dealing with possessed people. And there was a reference made to, hey, David wrote these things through power given to him from the Most High. And here we have the Most High referenced in Psalm 91. Now, again, if you've read anything in the unseen realm, you know that this is important terminology. Because the Most High, again, this is the title given to the God of Israel when he divides up the nations. Again, it's a title of superiority. He is the Most High. He is the one, you know, who made this decision, you know, who judges, you know, the rebellious, you know, divine beings of Genesis 6, who dealt with the Nakash of Genesis 3. Again, you have this Most High terminology. And that's important because you have to assert authority. You have to presume and assert and actually legitimately have authority over other Elohim, over other divine beings, again, to do what you're going to do, to do what needs to be done. And so there's this, again, conceptual link back to we're doing this because of the Most High and his power. But the Messiah, son of David, was, again, Jesus is actually called Son of the Most High in the Gospels. And that is a messianic title because the King of Israel, again, the King from the line of David, is referred to as the Son of God in the Old Testament. So again, there's this linkage about the messianic figure, Son of David, you know, Son of Solomon, line of David and Solomon, Son of the Most High, Son of God, all this sort of stuff factoring into what this psalm and again, what Jesus actually does in the Gospels with demonic entities. "So he who dwells in the shelter of the Most High will abide in the shadow of the Almighty. I will say to the Lord, my refuge and my fortress, my God in whom I trust. For he will deliver you from the snare of the fowler and from the deadly pestilence. He will cover you with his pinions, and under his wings you will find refuge. His faithfulness is a shield and buckler." Now here we get hit verses 5 and 6. We're going to get some lines in here that it's very easy to read right over, but we're going to be linking out to some things and talking about them. "You will not fear the terror of the night." Okay, the terror of the night. In Old Testament thinking, this was actually a demonic entity. Now, if you have the Dictionary of Deities and Demons in the Bible, again, I've recommended that source many, many times. This term is discussed. There's actually an entry for the terror of the night in DDD. And the Hebrew for this is Pakad Laila. Okay, now, Laila is the important thing to sort of fix in your brain, Laila, the way that sounds. Because, to quote the article, "there have been some attempts to relate Laila etymologically to Lilith, which is referenced in Isaiah 34:14. This is Lilith, again, which is a demonic figure in Jewish tradition. But the entry continues, "Akkadian Lili is actually a better choice. Akkadian Lili was a night demon." So Lili, Laila, it's different than Lilith. It's close, but it's not quite the same. But this term, Pakad Laila, DDD suggests, you know, there might be some relationship here. They say this is a folk etymology. Functionally, however, the demon Pakad Laila reveals traits similar to those of the Mesopotamian Lilu and the Lili, especially as it's referenced in the Song of Solomon 3:8, which talks about, again, the terror of the night. We're not going to necessarily go there. But you get this idea that there's an Akkadian term that aligns with this one that has characteristics that would sort of fit with, again, a demonic figure, terror of the night. Now, the terror of the night demon in Mesopotamia was, again, an aggressive, attacking entity. And the night association is significant because that's when lots of, you know, people sort of thought about when, you know, when demons are doing something. And it also has reference to what happens at night, specifically in bed between men and women. Okay, there's the marital bed. Also, again, the care of children during the night while they're asleep, because the Akkadian demons associated with this were often associated with children dying during the night and whatnot, or trying to prevent conception. Again, there's this notion of demonic activity during the midnight hours, I guess you could put it. And this term is associated with that. And I want to read you a little bit more from the DDD entry. He says, the writer says, among the host of Mesopotamian demons, Lilu, which is related to Sumerian Lu-Li-La, which literally means wind man. So it's like a spirit man. Among the host of Mesopotamian demons, Lilu and Lilitu or Lili, most resemble the biblical Pakad Laila. These demons seem to have been attached particularly to pregnant women and newborns whom they sought to harm. They are conceived as harmful to brides and grooms whom they attack on their wedding night and prevent the consummation of the marriage. As an attacker of brides and grooms, Lilu, or especially in Jewish tradition, Lilit, comes close, now catch this line, comes close to the incubus and succubus demons known from all over the world. Again, just giving you a little bit of a flavor of what's going on here. Again, this, I don't want to drift off into, you know, facade territory or alien abduction stuff, but thematically, there's a lot of overlap here between, you know, like, and sleep paralysis, even though I think sleep paralysis is just a biological medical condition, but, you know, it's often associated with feeling like a presence in the room. But again, you get these sorts of things. I'm just trying to pluck examples out so that you get a feel for what this term in antiquity would have been used to describe, or how this term would have been brought into discussion based upon some experience somebody had, whether it was supernatural or something that just freaked them out, that might have been natural or not. So this is the terminology that's going on in this particular psalm, back to the terror of the night in Psalm 91. A cursory look, last line from DDD, a cursory look at the context in which Pakad Laila occurs in Psalm 91 reveals its demonic identity. This psalm abounds with names of other demons. And it does. Let's go back to Psalm 91. Verse 5, we read, "You shall not fear the terror of the night." Here's the next one. "Nor the arrow that flies by day." Now you say, well, isn't that just like an arrow? I don't want to get stuck with an arrow that somebody shot off. Well, again, there's a little bit more to it than that, especially if you are reading this psalm in the Septuagint. Because in the Septuagint, instead of arrow that flies by day, you actually get daimonion mesame brinon, which means midday demon. Okay? So you will not feel the terror of the night, the nighttime demons, and you won't fear the midday demons either in the Septuagint. Now, DDD also has a reference to this. I'll read you a few excerpts. "The midday demon is found in the Septuagint version of Psalm 91. In that case, it's verse 6. English Bibles, it's going to be verse 5. In these verses, the Hebrew psalmist declares that the one who takes refuge in the Almighty will not fear." Again, Masoretic text, "terror of the night, nor the arrow that flies by day." And then it continues to the pestilence and the destruction. And we're going to get to those in a moment. Those are also names of gods in antiquity, in Canaanite religion, And those gods are referred to as demons in the Septuagint. But just hold that thought for a moment. So back to the entry for Midday Demon. Again, this is the Septuagint version. The Septuagint translators, continuing with the entry, confronted a different Hebrew text. And then he references probably the same ones that Aquila and Symmachus used. And then he gets into the Hebrew for what they probably read. Destruction and demon of noontime. Again, according to the Hebrew text they probably had, which the Septuagint renders as misfortune and the midday demon. So it's very clear in the Septuagint that what they are reading, and again, D.D. says they probably, you know, had a text that actually led them this direction. A Hebrew text is a little bit different than the Masoretic text. But in this verse, you know, the psalmist is saying, you know, if you're under the shelter of the Most High, the one who's really in charge of, again, all these other entities, you will not fear the terror of the night, the nighttime demon. You will not fear, again, the midday demon, the one that shows up, you know, in the middle of the day, that sort of thing. You won't need to fear these things. Now, before we leave this, if you go with the Masoretic text, the arrow that flies by day, there are scholars who would actually argue, and with, I think this is a reasonable argument, that the reference to the arrow provides a clue, actually, to a demonic entity, because in Canaanite religion, the god Reshef, who was a plague god, is represented as an archer, someone who shoots arrows. And so that, again, that might have contributed, that knowledge in antiquity might have contributed to the Septuagint translator when he's looking at what he looks at and he has different options. It might have led him to say, okay, we got it, midday demon. You know, this, we get it because of this, the way Reshef, again, was depicted and described in Canaanite literature. So even if you want to go with MT, you don't like Septuagint, you can still be dealing with a demonic entity here. And Reshef, again, was a deity, was a god in Canaanite religion. Continuing on to the next verse. So you won't feel a terror of the night. You won't, you know, need to fear either the arrow. Again, the Reshef's darts. Remember, you know, what Paul talks about, the fiery darts, you know, of the wicked. It's the same idea, but here in the Old Testament, that here you have a deity associated with this, represented as an archer, shooting at his victims, that sort of thing. Or if you go with the Septuagint, the midday demon. We continue, nor will you have to fear the pestilence that walks in darkness, nor the destruction that wastes at noonday. Now, so catch what the psalmist just did there. The previous verse, we have terror of the night, nighttime demon, and then we have a daytime demon. Next verse, we have the pestilence that's stalking in the darkness. There we go with nighttime. Nor the destruction that wastes at noonday. Here we have noonday at reference again. So you could take verses 5 and 6 as parallel to each other. It's another way, again, instead of it yielding 4 demonic figures, it would only be 2 demonic figures described 2 times in different ways. Either way, these are hostile divine entities, hostile gods in Canaanite literature that are, again, viewed as the forces of darkness, spiritual forces of darkness that the psalmist is saying, you don't need to fear these things. Now let's talk about pestilence a little bit, this term. And this is something that, you know, shows up in a footnote somewhere in Unseen Realm. I know, I don't quite remember what the chapter was, but the Hebrew word here is dever. Again, pestilence is a normal translation. But the thing to notice here, to be aware of, is that this dever, okay, is a deity name in the Ugaritic texts, and he is the god, a god of destruction. Now, again, Dever in Ugaritic text is also mentioned in concert with, in tandem with, Reshef. That was the arrow demon, the archer demon that we just read about in the previous verse. So again, this is what that quote in DDD much earlier said, hey, the context of Psalm 91 supports this demonic thinking, because look at all these terms in the psalm that point to demonic entities. That was an accurate quote. There are a number of things in the psalm that point that direction. Dever is also mentioned in Habakkuk 3. Again, we have there, might as well just go out to Habakkuk 3, where Dever and Reshef are actually in this scene. We have here, I'll just start at the beginning. O Lord, I have heard the report of you, and your work, O Lord, do I fear. In the midst of the years, revive it. In the midst of the years, make it known. In wrath, remember mercy. God came from Timon, and the Holy One from Mount Paran. His splendor covered the heavens. The earth was full of his praise. His brightness was like the light. Rays flashed from his hand, and there he veiled his power. Before him went pestilence, and plague followed at his heels. So there you have Dever and Resheph mentioned in this. And in this scene, they are sort of like cringing, you know, servants. They're underlings of the God of Israel. Again, this the prayer of Habakkuk here puts them in their place. So they're not, you know, independent, you know, more powerful entities or anything like that. You know, the God of Israel can use destruction and he can use pestilence and that sort of thing. But what you get is you get in Canaanite religion, these are distinct deities and they're in opposition, of course, to what's going on in Israel. And in the Psalm, you know, they become enemies, they become rebels, they become threats, you know, to God's people. And that's why we have this Psalm that you don't need to fear these entities because the God of Israel is more powerful than they are. And in fact, again, the supposition is that the Most High can and will deliver you from these things. So let's go to, again, quickly, the other reference, the destruction reference. This is not Resheph. This is Ketev. The term Ketev appears four times in the Old Testament. DDD again. Its basic significance is destruction. In Ugaritic, this name would be pronounced Kezev. And it occurs once in Ugaritic, and Kezev is a buddy or kinsman of Mot, the god of death, in Ugaritic thinking. And in Hosea 13:14, we get a reference to this kind of material. It's going to sound like a familiar passage, but think about this passage and think about where it's referenced in the New Testament. Hosea says, again, and the speaker here is, let me get the context here for the speaker, Hosea 13. It is the prophet. He's talking about he destroys you, O Israel. Again, Hosea basically giving Israel bad news for their idolatry. And then we get to verse 14. Shall I ransom them from the power of Sheol? Again, the realm of the dead. Shall I redeem them from death? The word mot. O death, O mot, where are your plagues? And the word there is Dever. O Sheol, where is your sting? The word there is Ketev. Compassion is hidden from my eyes. Now, where do we see that quoted in the New Testament? O death, okay, where is your sting? Okay, all that sort of thing. We get it in 1 Corinthians 15:55. O death, where is your victory? O death, where is your sting? And it's a passage about the resurrection, okay, because the resurrected Messiah and the resurrection itself conquers death, conquers Sheol, conquers the plagues that, you know, people get that send them to the underworld. You know, it conquers the destruction, again, that results in people dying and all this sort of stuff. It's a reference to, again, the power of the God of Israel over these forces, these entities, these things, and ultimately even the power of death. Well, that's important because all of those things, the resurrection, is tied to the Messiah. Okay, this was the plan of salvation. The Messiah needs to die and rise again to, again, complete, to really bring into effect, kickstart, bring to fruition the whole plan of salvation, salvation history in the Old Testament. And the Messiah is the son of David. The Messiah is the son of Solomon. Okay, again, the Davidic line. All of these ideas, again, are interconnected in the Old Testament mind, as part of the messianic profile. The Messiah will have power over the terror of the night. The Messiah will have power over the terror of the day. Again, nighttime demon, daytime demon. The Messiah will have power over pestilence, Dever, destruction, Ketev. Both of them are buddies of Mot, death, in Hosea 13:14. The Messiah will have the power over, now catch what I'm saying here. Again, if you've read The Unseen Realm, this is going to click with you pretty easily. The Messiah has the power over the realm of death, the Lord of the dead, who is Satan, and everybody who works for him. Okay, the minions in the realm of the dead, who are, in the Old Testament context, they're described by these God terms, these pseudo lesser hostile God terms. In the Septuagint, this terminology is going to be put into demonic terms. And in the New Testament, in Greek, all of this is going to be put under demonic terms, because this is where the demons dwell. Yes, the demons in the Gospels, demons in the New Testament are the spirits of the dead Nephilim. We get that. Again, we're not going to go over all that ground in this podcast episode. But this is where they live, okay? Even in the Old Testament, you get that. You know, you get the dead Rephaim, who are Anakim, who are descendants of the Nephilim. You get them living in the underworld. They live in the realm of the dead. They come out, they seek embodiment, they seek to possess people. Again, we understand that from the Gospels, but who is Lord of all of this? Okay, who's Lord of the dead? Who's Lord of the minions running around that run the place, that afflict people, okay, that bring destruction and plague and all this stuff, and of course the Lord of the dead himself? Well, the answer is the Messiah. The answer is the Messiah. And so people who were familiar, again, with this literature, Psalm 91, the extra psalm, Psalm 151. Again, the reference in extra psalm material about, hey, you know, David had written songs, and suggestion, hint, maybe Psalm 91 is one of them. David had written psalms to perform over the possessed, four of them. Remember that Dead Sea Scroll we read a few minutes ago? So if you're familiar with this material, when Jesus shows up and starts casting out demons, starts giving his disciples power over demons, the theological messaging is quite clear. This is, again, this guy has to be the Messiah, because only the son of David, only the messianic figure, only the messianic king would have been authorized, would have been empowered to do this. And to do it for real, as you know, other than, you know, being a pretender, he not only has the power, but he dispenses it to his followers, to his disciples. And again, it's no coincidence that when Jesus does this stuff, the first time that he does this is he sends out the 70. Okay, it's always done in conjunction with the launch, the kickstarting of the kingdom of God over against the kingdom of Satan. Again, all of these things have to be taken together collectively in context. They are part of the messianic profile that in and of itself is splintered, is scattered. And the pieces start coming together and converging into and around, you know, clustered, you know, in connection with this figure, Jesus of Nazareth. I mean, again, the theological messaging would not have been lost to someone, again, familiar with these texts. And I'm not saying they could quote them. I mean, I'm sure a lot of them could. But even if they had heard them, when Jesus starts doing this stuff, the bells and whistles are going to go, you know, going to start going off in their head. They would associate this with Messiah. Now, one passage yet to mention about that people would have conceivably had in their head, at least by the time of the writing of the Gospels, would be something Josephus says. Josephus, in his Antiquities book, and again, Josephus was a first century figure, so again, you would have had to, you know, the gospel readers and writers may not have had this, but certainly Josephus is going to be, is actually sharing Jewish tradition, you know, with his readers. He doesn't just make this up when he decides to write something down. He writes this: "Now the sagacity and wisdom which God had bestowed upon Solomon was great, so great that he exceeded the ancients, insomuch that he was no way inferior to the Egyptians." Again, he's drawing on that 1 Kings 4 passage that we read, "who are said to have been beyond all men in understanding." Okay, this is Antiquities 8.2.5, if you want the actual references. This is line 45 now. "God also enabled him," Solomon, "to learn that skill which expels demons, which is a science useful and sanative to men. He composed such incantations," again, utterances, songs, you know, this sort of thing, you know, stuff that you say or sing. "He composed such incantations also by which distempers are alleviated." So he was a healer too. "And he left behind him the manner of using exorcisms by which they drive away demons so that they may never return." Again, this is part of Jewish thinking. This was associated with Solomon. Again, because of some of the texts that we had read, you know, we read earlier in this episode. And by the time Jesus shows up, there's a body of tradition based upon, again, Qumran material, you know, Jewish material. This is Hebrew Jewish material that, of course, gets translated into the Septuagint and the, you know, Psalm 91, the extra psalm, Psalm 151, which is in the Septuagint, also helps create this body of thought, this body of tradition that associated the Son of David Okay, the son of Solomon, the Solomonic Davidic line, associated that messianic figure with the casting out of demons. And this is why when Jesus starts doing this, nobody blinked an eye. Nobody said, hey, where's the Messiah supposed to be doing that? Chapter and verse, please. No, they don't say that. They again, have this expectation because of this material. And so that's why, again, this part of the messianic profile that we read in the Gospels that isn't very transparent in the Old Testament, why it's still a legitimate connection back into the Old Testament as part of, you know, the messianic figure, the messianic profile.
Mike, what are the modern day Catholic exorcists' view on Psalm 151? Do you know?
I don't know. I've not read Catholic exorcism stuff to know if the I haven't read enough of that to know if they draw on Psalm 151 or Psalm 91 or not, or if it's just, again, their own, I hate to put it this way, but their own, you know, incantations, their own things that are drawn from their own theology, that's part of their renunciation ritual. I don't know what their ritual is. You know, and I should add, you know, like, again, I referenced the Fern and Audrey episode, but we need to be clear. Again, they are very distrustful of deliverance ministry for a number of reasons that people can go back and listen to that episode and understand why. So when we talk about this psalm and some of this material with them, they're not creating their own renunciations. Like they're going out and deliver, you know, it's not deliverance ministry. They're not commanding demons to cast out. They're not doing exorcisms. The Fern and Audrey episode will make clear that sometimes they run into that. And again, people can go back and listen to some of the comments they made about dealing with that, but they are not doing deliverance ministry. So they're not, this is not like what you see with Catholic exorcisms, which, to be honest with you, I'm fairly skeptical. I'm actually a lot skeptical of. I would never say that what they do is never successful in a real way, but I think a lot of what they run into is something else that sort of gets filed in that drawer of exorcisms. But I don't want to be so derogatory as to think that there's just this complete divorce from what a Catholic priest does and the demonic realm. I mean, I think there can be some overlap there, but I just want it to be clear to the audience that I'm not advocating that sort of thing, but and neither is Fern and Audrey. But they find the material, the theology. They find the theology helpful. And again, if listeners want to go back and listen to that episode, they can to get a little more insight into it.
All right. Well, good deal, Mike. Another good topic episode.
Yeah, we're picking them off.
Well, next week we're going to be talking about the spiritual body in 1 Corinthians 15, correct?
Yep. What was Paul thinking in 1 Corinthians 15 when he wrote about that?
All right, well, good deal. Is there anything else you'd like to add to the show?
No.
Okay. Well, with that, we thank you. And I want to thank everybody else for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.